Thank you, Dr. Friedman, for the eulogy. I'm really privileged and honored and very happy to be again here for the second time. And I want to be mekayem what Chazal have said, potchim bechvod achsaniya tchila. It is really a pleasure to thank Rabbi Kelman, Dr. Friedman, the Torah in Motion crew, and everyone who contributed to this conference, which we already know from experience that is very successful, and we are sure that this time we will all be inspired and learn more. According to Rebbe, two times is already a chazoke, so we certainly expect the next one, and once you do the next one, then according to all shittas it will be a chazoke. So hopefully we will meet here for many years to come. The topic that I was asked to talk is Jewish versus secular medical ethics. And indeed, in the last four or five decades, the ethical aspects of medicine has been developed to a degree that made a major change in the way we practice medicine today. And despite my white beard, I'm not an ancient person, and I remember being a medical student that all this that we are going to talk today and in the coming days of the conference were almost non-issues. No one really spent any time on that, and I think that is a real revolution. So what I would like to do is to discuss a little bit some of the secular approaches to medical ethics, some of the Jewish approaches to medical ethics. Obviously, we can only highlight the issues because each topic requires a full conference, and then compare between them and see, are we similar, are we identical, are we different, and in what areas. So let me start by some aspects of secular medical ethics. Historically, it is said that the first one to compose some kind of an ethical program to physicians was Hippocrates, and subsequently organizations like the American Medical Association, the British Medical Association, and finally the WHO have composed a whole series of regulations how a physician has to act on a ethical basis. Now, I don't know if anyone knows what the Hippocratic Oath is saying, although I'm sure that many of the physicians here have taken the oath of Hippocrates, but probably most of us don't remember what it says. And it's good that we don't remember, because what it says is almost irrelevant to what we call medical ethics. Primarily because Hippocrates was a physician and he decided how a physician should act ethically towards his patient without consulting with a patient. That was the whole concept of medical ethics in Hippocrates' oath, which was called a paternalistic approach. The physician knows better what the patient needs and wants, and therefore the patient should not be involved because he doesn't know anything. And that certainly is not what we call today medical ethics. But that was a format of dealing with ethical issues in medicine. Now, if we talk about ethics or about medical ethics, in fact we are talking about something which is outside the scientific normative way of medicine. Medicine belongs to the, let's say, the mathematical, physical, chemical fields of knowledge, whereas philosophy is a different branch, and we have to combine between the two. As a teacher to students in medical schools, I realize time and again that medical students have great difficulty to make a switch in their mind from mathematical thinking, from scientific thinking, into a philosophical, ethical thinking, And indeed, if medical ethics should succeed, it will be only if we can do this switch in the mind of people who are used to think only science. So modern medical ethics, as opposed to medical ethics in Hippocratic and on, is actually a multidisciplinary, pluralistic approach which is based on a whole host of fields of science and religion and law and history and behavior and social aspects, and really it involves many experts to come out with something which will be meaningful as we understand it today. Now, I'll try to answer these five questions: why, when, who, what, and how do we deal with modern medical ethics? Why? The reason that medical ethics has become such a field that in almost every conference there are some aspects to it, and some conferences are devoted totally to medical ethics, is because of a whole host of changes that have occurred in the past 4 or 5 decades. The major one is the rapid scientific advances that happened within a very short period of time. Organ transplants, modern fertility technologies, genetics in the modern way, PGD, dying patients who can be treated to prolong the dying process much longer than ever before, definition of moment of death which has changed or is being changed. All these created a need to answer ethical questions. The facts are here, but how do you deal with these facts? Is it okay to get organs from a brain dead person? Is it okay to get an egg donation? Is it okay to do a PGD procedure? All these are questions that came because of the scientific advancement. If this wouldn't have happened, then the questions would have been much minor than they are today. Similarly, a major change has occurred in the patient-physician relationship. As I mentioned earlier, for 2,500 years, the relationship was a paternalistic relationship, where the physician decided for the patient, presumably for his good, although not always was it right, but certainly the idea was that the physician is trying to do the best for his patient, but from his perspective, from his knowledge, from his philosophy, and from his ethics. This has totally changed, and today a patient-physician relationship is an autonomous relationship whereby the patient makes the decisions. The patient needs to get all the information in order for him to make the decision, even if the physician thinks that he's wrong, even if the physician thinks that he's making a mistake. Yet the decision should lie with the patient and not with the physician, and that has changed a lot of our behavior as physicians because of this philosophical change in the patient-physician relationship. There have also occurred major socio-cultural changes. In the old days, especially in Europe, health professor was something close to God, and if the professor said something, everyone accepted it, there were no arguments. He may have said the stupidest thing, yet it was accepted because her professor said it. Nowadays, you go to a physician only to seek a second opinion. You don't come to get his opinion. So there are real changes in society that have occurred in the last few decades. Another major issue is the fact that we have scarce resources. There's no country in the world, neither Canada nor the United States, certainly not Israel, that can supply all the demands to all patients with the most advanced facilities and equipment that are required to treat patients. No country can do it. So we have to decide on priorities. And that is a major ethical question. How do you decide to which patient you give what and how much, and who do you take away certain things because of scarce resources? A major issue that has its sources already in the Talmud. But the questions were minor questions. They were interesting from a philosophical point of view, but on a daily basis, they occurred very rarely. If two people go in the desert and they have only one liter of water, and which is sufficient only for one of the two, who gets this water was an intellectual question, but how often does such a thing occur? But today, every day, the question is, should I send him to an MRI or not? It's very costly. Should I operate on him or not? These are daily questions, and these issues became very difficult to solve. And finally, there's a whole range of public involvement, starting with the media, through courts, and a physician is usually operating in an atmosphere and in a world where a lawyer is running after him for every action, because maybe he'll catch him with something and he can sue him. Or maybe something was done very unusual and he can report it and get some credit for being the first to report something which might be harmful to everyone else. So these are issues that all came together. They're all different. Yet they came together and they required answers from a wider range of people to answer them. So that is why we need a different set of medical ethics today compared to 50 or 100 years ago. Just to exemplify some of the issues that we are dealing with in medical ethics, the terminally ill patient. 100 years ago, there were terminally ill patients as well. 1,000 years ago, patients died as well. We didn't invent in the 21st century the fact that people are dying. That's not our invention. We claim that we do everything today anew, but that certainly is not something that we invented. Yet, the questions then and the questions today are totally different. In principle, they might be similar, but in practice, what could someone do 500 years ago for a dying patient? Let's say you have to do everything possible to prolong every minute of life. What did it mean then? It meant to say, another capital tilim. It meant to, what did it mean? We didn't have any means to do it. Today, we have respirators, and we have dialysis machines, and we have chemotherapy, and we have radiotherapy, and we can prolong actually life, and the question is it right or wrong to do it? So this is a real question. All the reproductive technologies didn't even exist 50 or 100 years ago. Egg donation, surrogate mothers, even sperm donation, a little older than the newer technologies, yet they are only 60, 70 years old. They are new technologies, and they create major questions. If a woman gets an egg donation, who is the mother of the child that will be born? Does it go by the genetics? Does it go by the nurturing delivery system? Who would be the mother of such a child? We never encountered a situation where a child is a product of two separate women. Everyone giving half of the fact of her motherhood that this child was produced. So these are real issues that need to get answers, and as you can see and as you probably know, there is a whole host of such difficult issues that are all new. There are older questions, but they became more pronounced because of this change from paternalism to autonomy. So disclosing information to a patient, which sometimes is a very painful process. You have to tell a patient that he has a terrible disease and he's going to die within a certain period of time. That is not easy to do. In the old days, we didn't do it. We just didn't tell the patient anything. We treated him because we knew better what is good for him. Today, we are obligated, both by ethics and by law, to tell the patient what he has, what the options are, and what the prognosis is. This makes the life of a physician and a patient much more difficult than years ago, and the same goes for other similar issues. There are also issues of public health policies, human experimentation, mass screening of genetic diseases, preventive medicine, immunization, enforced, not enforced, all the new technologies and scarce resources, where do you put the money to develop something new or to help people with the old technologies, but many more people can be helped. All these are examples of issues that ethics has to deal with. When is it right to teach medical ethics? Certainly in medical school. And again, as I mentioned, I didn't have any course in medical ethics when I went to medical school. But today, I think there's hardly a medical school that doesn't have some format of teaching medical ethics. It is certainly important to continue the teaching of medical ethics in postgraduate sessions. People like you, like me, who come to conferences, even as adult, mature physicians, still need to talk about medical ethics because there are everyday new issues and everyday new approaches. So the answer is when, always. Once you are a physician, you have always to deal with medical ethics. And the nice thing and the complicated thing about medical ethics is that it involves every physician. You can be an internist, a pediatrician, a surgeon, an oncologist, a geriatrics. Everyone has ethical problems in his field, some specific and some general, and everyone really has to learn it and know what to do. Who should teach it? I won't go into it. And to whom you should teach? There's a whole debate now, but that's not the topic of our session. What should we teach? I don't have the time to spend on the major issues that medical ethics has to include, but there are complicated matters in teaching medical ethics, as I mentioned earlier, to students whose mind is more in a scientific fashion. And when you talk about utilitarianism, deontology, values, things that are more abstract, we find it sometimes difficult to get it across. But without it, it is very difficult to understand why one decision is ethical and another is not. I'll go into the principles in a minute because I think this is the core of what we are going to talk. In recent years, in Georgetown and in other centers, ethicists have developed what they call the four principles approach. They enumerated four principles, assuming that if you act according to those principles, you can act in an ethical fashion. And what they decided are the principles in medical ethics are autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice, without going into too much clarifications, especially on justice. There are so many theories of justice. We are really talking about distributive justice, which has to do with the issue of scarce resources. So the assumption is that if you take a case which has an ethical dilemma in it and you analyze it according to these four principles, you'll come to a solution in every case. But you have to understand the principles, the four principles, and apply them correctly. What turned out to be in recent years, especially in this country, in the United States, is that everything turned out to be autonomy. For instance, if you talk about beneficence, beneficence means you have to try to do the best for the patient, to do good for him. But what is good? How do you define what is good? So the Americans say, what is good? What the patient thinks is good. So we're coming back to autonomy. Non-maleficence, you're not allowed to do something bad to the patient. What is bad? How do you define bad? What is bad to me is not necessarily bad to him. So you come back to autonomy. And actually, if you think about it, in the American way of practicing medicine from an ethical point of view, there's only one principle, and that is autonomy. Whatever the patient wants, do it for him. It's exaggerated a little bit, but not very much. Now, it became certainly an overriding ethical principle, where, from a philosophical point of view, it requires the respect for the intrinsic value of a human being as being a whole human being who is an individual different than other people, the freedom, the self-determination, ownership of self, and a better knowledge of personal good. Who knows best what is good for me? Only I, not the physician and not someone else. I am the one who knows what's good for me, and therefore, to fulfill all these principles, autonomy is the overriding ethical principle. Just as a side note, even in America, one thing overrides autonomy, and that is money. So that if a patient, for instance, a dying patient says, I have enough, I suffered enough, another half a year won't add anything to me, I don't want you to treat me anymore, I want to die. Autonomy. You decided you don't want treatment, we won't give you treatment. In the meantime, we gained a little money as well. But how about a patient who says, I am dying, but in 2 weeks, I have a bar mitzvah of my grandson, and I want to live to see it. And I want you to do everything to make me alive for this period of time. Which means, treat me with all the machinery, with all the medications. Very costly. The American philosophy says, well, autonomy, autonomy, but it's too costly to do it. So we won't give it to you. So the overriding principle over autonomy is money. You can justify it, scarce resources, prioritization of expenses, everything is right. But if autonomy is the overriding principle, it should go to both directions, which in most instances it doesn't go. So taking away this issue, autonomy became actually the overriding principle. However, even autonomy, to the autonomists, to those who prefer autonomy over any other principle, there are some limitations. Some are widely accepted, some are less, but there are limitations. What are the limitations? First of all, the autonomy has to be given by an autonomous agent, by a person who is competent. If a 3-year-old child says, it's cold outside, but I want to run out with short pants, the father will say, oh no, you'll get sick. You must wear long pants. So it's against his autonomy. But everyone understands that a 3-year-old is not an autonomous agent. He doesn't understand. So therefore, I become a paternalistic. Pater, by the way, is a father, right? So I, as a father, tell my child, do this or do that, and I'm overriding his autonomy. Why? Because he's not competent. So the same holds true for patients. They may be adults, but they are mentally retarded, they are psychotic, they are demented. So those can't exercise autonomy. They don't have an autonomy. So for them, autonomy is not a principle at all. You can't apply it. So you need other principles. The other limitation, which is obvious, is that my autonomy cannot harm someone else's autonomy. If I decide that the shirt of someone is a very nice one, and autonomously I want this shirt, I can't go and take it off his body and take it. Although I have my autonomy. That is my wish. But my wish contradicts someone else's autonomy, and therefore you can't exercise the autonomy. A third limitation, which is debatable how far it should go, is if it is accepted within societal norms. For instance, in the United States, in all states, if a dying patient comes and says, I don't want to live anymore, I don't want you to treat me, but that's not enough, because even if you won't treat me, I'll still live another 3 months, but I don't want to live this 3 months. So what is my option? That you, the physician, kill me now. A nicer word is euthanasia, which is take a gun and shoot me. In hospitals, usually you don't shoot, so you give a drug which does the same thing, right? So you kill him. In Holland, it's legally acceptable. If a patient comes and says, I don't want to live anymore, the physician will inject a lethal dose of a medication and kill him. In the United States, it can't be done. Where's the autonomy? How are you overriding his autonomy? He doesn't want to live anymore. And you have the means to help him not to live anymore. But because the society, at least for the moment, I don't know what will happen in our next conference, but at this conference, still the norm in the American society is that you can't kill a patient even if he requests it. That's a problem from a philosophical point of view. If you take autonomy as an overriding principle, why do you stop here? So the answer is, you have to go within societal norms. In two states in the United States, in Oregon and in Washington, physician-assisted suicide has become a norm. So you can do it. In New York, in this state where we are now, you can't do it because the societal norm of this state doesn't allow to fulfill the autonomous wish of a patient to commit suicide by your help, with your help. So these are some of the limitations, which the question is, who sets those limitations? Who is the society that says, this type of autonomy I'm respecting, and that type of autonomy I'm not respecting? That's a major problem in the system of autonomy. Sometimes, countries impose measures on individuals against their autonomy. For instance, everyone is required when he's driving to have a belt. If I drive and I say autonomously, I don't want to put it on, who are you to tell me that I must do it? You are caring for me? You are saying if you do it and if Khalila there will be a car accident, you'll be saved or you'll be less harmed? What do you care? It's my autonomy. I decided that I am more comfortable to move around without the belt, and I don't want it. Yet, society enforces it against autonomy. So what I'm trying to point out to you, and you'll see in a minute why I'm trying so hard to do it, is that societal norms can override autonomy. And it is only a question who makes these norms and who decides that these are the right norms. Obviously, autonomy has to be balanced against other values. Autonomy of the patient has to take into some account the physician's autonomy. Let's say a patient says, I want you not to treat me, I want to die. But the physician, as a human being, thinks that this is a wrong decision and he can't be part of letting someone die when he can help him. Can the autonomy of the patient override the autonomy of the physician? Or vice versa? What do you do in this situation? And the most important thing to me are the cultural differences. Autonomy became an overriding principle in the United States, maybe in Canada as well. But it is not an overriding principle in some parts of Europe. They didn't accept it altogether. They are not an overriding principle in Israel from a philosophical point of view. So there are cultural differences on how far do you go with autonomy. And the fact that here people think or are educated that autonomy is the most important value doesn't mean that the whole world is United States. There are some other parts in the world that may be as good and as smart as the United States and not respect autonomy to such a degree. And that goes together with some of these points that I'm trying to make. So the cultural differences are based upon several principles, which I won't go into all of them. Time doesn't permit me to do this, but I want to just to discuss two of them. One is principles versus casuistry. The four principle approach says if you take the four principles and you throw them on every case, you'll find a solution. Practice, I'm sure to the physicians here, shows that it's not so. You have many problems that by just looking at the four principles, you can't solve the problem. Why? Because individual problems have nuances that make a major difference, although in principle they are very similar. So the principle may be right, but this particular case has something in it that doesn't fit into this principle. Or this particular case is a situation where there is a contradiction between one or two of the four principles. It may be beneficial on the one hand, but unfair and not justified on the other hand. It may be the autonomous wish of the patient, but not in his benefit. So how do you decide and balance between contradicting points? So the principle approach is problematic in a practical point of view. It is a very good principle, a very good approach to give a lecture on. To sit in a hall, air conditioned, near a lake, and talk about principles. That's very nice. But when you come to apply it in practice, it is, in many instances, not helpful. As opposed to it, there is a different approach, which is called the casuistry approach. Casuistry from the word case, case by case. You take the case, you dissect it according to the ethical issues that the case presents, and you build up towards the principle. And many times you get to different conclusions than if you would have come the other direction. By the way, in Jewish law, at least in the last 1,000 years, the casuistry approach, not named this way, is the responsa situation. Every shaila to a rov is not a principal shaila. You don't ask a rov a principle. You tell him a story. I encountered this and this situation with this and this specific issues. What do I do? And the answer of the rabbi will be on this particular case, but he can build from it to a principle. And then if another one has a similar condition, he can learn from that. But the approach is case by case. Every tshuva is a tshuva on a case, on a specific case. The second issue is rights versus duties. We live in a society, the modern society is a society of rights. In Hebrew we say magiali. I deserve everything. You all have to supply what I need. That is rights. Jewish law doesn't recognize rights at all. We don't have any rights. We only have duties. We talk about mitzvot. Mitzvah is a commandment. We are commanded to do for others. The question is, what can I do for you, not what you can do for me? And some presidents try to do it in the United States, not very successfully, but that is the concept of Judaism, that we don't have rights. We have only duties. And I'll try to show you some of the differences that are in practical medical terms, these differences between rights and duties. There are other issues, again, time is a little short. Now, a very difficult issue from a philosophical point of view is moral polarities. For example, if you take the abortion issue, there are people who are called pro-life, who would say that abortion is never permissible. There is no exception. You can never kill a fetus, even if it means that the mother will die. And if the mother will die, the fetus will die. Yet you can't kill the fetus in order to save the mother. Certainly, you can't kill the fetus to save the fetus from himself, if he has a defect or a disease. That is a pro-life. The other extreme is pro-choice. A woman comes and says, this fetus in my body is part of me. The same way as I decide when to cut my hair and how long to cut the hair, I can decide when to abort and when not to abort. That is part of me. That is a pro-choice approach. So these are two extremes. How do you reconcile between them? What is right and what is wrong? Is there a right and wrong in an absolute term? Or when you talk about a terminally ill, you can say he's going to die, but I have means to prolong his life. Not for long, for a few months, but I can do it. So those who feel that the value of life is an absolute value will say, you must do it. Every minute of life is as important as 70 years of life. And if you have the means to prolong the life by even a week or a month, you must do it, because that's the value of life. On the other hand, if you go by autonomy, if I say I don't want to live anymore, and I don't want to live even a minute anymore, I want to die now, so I'll kill you. So these are, again, two extremes. And you can go through most practices in medicine to polarities. How do you solve this problem from an ethical point of view? Now let me turn now to some Jewish aspects and principles, and I'll show you some things which are similar to the general ethical approach and some which are not. First of all, we certainly have ethical principles. We don't call them that way. We call them halakha. That's a law. The same law as to keep Shabbat and to put on film is the law to love my neighbor and to do good to him. These are laws from a Jewish philosophy. But translated to current terminology, these are ethical principles. You have to love your fellow man as yourself. What is hateful to you, do not do to others. Do what is righteous and good in the eyes of the Lord and man, and so on. So we have a whole set of ethical principles. We don't need to be ashamed compared to the world. But our principles are different than the principles that I just now spoke about. First of all, we don't go by general principles, period. That is certainly not sufficient. It's not enough to say, I believe in God, I believe in Moses, I believe in Tchiyat Amitim, I believe in the 13 Ikarim, and I'm a good Jew. Halachically, that's far from being a good Jew. You need to fulfill it with many, many details. All the Taryag Mitzvot, and all the thousands of branches coming out of the Taryag Mitzvot. There are thousands of things that we feel are part of being Jewish from a halachic point of view, and general principles are not enough. As you know, Christianity, which came out of Judaism, did this approach. They said, forget about the details, forget about all the mitzvot, just be a good person and believe in whatever kind of belief that they formulated. Now, as I mentioned already, in Judaism there are duties, there are obligations, there are responsibilities, there are no rights. We don't deserve anything. We should do for others. And again, the casuistic approach rather than the principle approach and some others. Now, one important point is the list that I gave you from the Georgetown mantra of the four principles, there's one major principle that was a principle throughout all generations that was omitted, and that is the value of life. Where is the value of life per se? You can be a very good person and benefit the other one. You can respect his autonomy. You can be fair and distribute resources in a fair way. But where's the value of life? They omitted it. There's no such value. Now they talk about quality of life, which is a very difficult term to define. I don't have the time to go into it. But the value of life per se has been omitted from current medical ethics. To me, it's a major mistake, and it has a lot of bad consequences. So obviously, from a Jewish point of view, the value of life is a very important value. Whether it's an absolute value, or extremely important, or very important, it's debatable. But it's certainly a value that has to be listed by itself. Now, when we approach polarities in Judaism, Maimonides has taught us how to do it, how to solve the problem. And what Maimonides taught us, and he put it in the code of law, it's not a philosophical approach, it's a legal approach, that whenever you have two diverse approaches, choose the middle way. Don't be extreme to the right, and don't be extreme to the left. Don't be too good, don't be too bad. Be in the middle. Don't be someone who is never angry, and don't be someone who is always angry. You can be sometimes angry, you should mostly not be angry. So you should choose the middle way, which was termed later as the golden middle pathway, and in most instances, that is something that can be done in medical ethics as well. Now, we have some rules and regulations which are unknown to the general medical ethics. One is that there's an obligation upon the physician to heal. A physician can't say, now I'm resting, now I am going for vacation. If a patient comes and he is in need, he has to treat it. Certainly a physician can't say, your nose doesn't look right to me, your insurance isn't exactly the insurance that I accept, and therefore I don't want to treat you. These are things which are wrong. From an ethical point of view, at least in most countries, a patient-physician relationship is a contractual relationship, which means we did a contract. But before we did a contract, we have no obligation. So that if a patient was accepted by me, everyone agrees that I have to treat him. But I have the right not to accept it. From a Jewish point of view, you don't have this right. You have an obligation to treat. So that is one issue. But even more important, from a Jewish point of view, there's an obligation upon the patient to seek medical help, which doesn't exist in a secular ethical approach. You can't tell a patient you must be treated if you have a disease. The patient can say, I don't want to be treated. And ethically, he might be okay. From a halachic point of view, he will be considered as someone who is attempting suicide. He can be treated, he can be saved, and he chose not to do it. So, in order to summarize some of the similarities and differences, I think we should look, and I'll do it briefly now, upon these four issues. The range of issues, the methods of analysis, the final conclusions, and the major principles. As to the range of issues, any general medical ethical issue is also a Jewish medical ethical issue. If you talk about organ transplants, if you talk about egg donation, if you talk about stem cell research, if you talk about PGD, all these are ethical problems and they are halachic problems. So halacha covers all the issues that secular ethics deals with. But halacha, from a physician's point of view, deals with more issues, which are not less important from a halachic point of view. For instance, how should a physician behave on Shabbat? That is a Jewish ethical or halachic issue, which is the most prevalent issue, affecting every physician every 7 days, and is a major issue. From a secular point of view, there's no difference between Sunday, Monday, or Shabbat. From their point of view, you don't have to deal with it. Issues of Yom Kippur, who should fast or who shouldn't fast, is a range within Jewish medical ethics. So there are many issues beyond secular ethics. So that a physician, a Jewish physician, who wants to operate according to halacha, has to be involved in many more issues than a secular physician who wants to behave ethically, because he has to do that plus. The methods of analysis obviously are very different. I don't have time to go into it, but there are different methods. It doesn't mean necessarily that the conclusions are always different, but the way to get to those conclusions are very different if you analyze halachically the question or ethically from a secular point of view. An important issue is the final conclusion. All ethicists will tell you that they don't make decisions. If you come to an ethical consult, he'll give you the pros and cons of each of the options, but he'll tell you at the end of the day you have to make the decision. Because I, as an ethicist, can only discuss the matter, can only show you the points, but I'm not qualified to make a decision for you. From a Jewish point of view, that is useless. You need to know what to do. You come to a rabbi, you don't come to him to hear a shear, tell you this side and that side, that you go for the Daf Yomi. But if you have an issue, you come to the rabbi and you want an answer. And halachically, a rabbi is required to give you an answer. Not all rabbis know how to give the answer. So if they are respectful, they will ask someone else. But they are responsible to give you an answer. So that Jewish law requires a final conclusion, whereas general ethics does not require it, and in fact doesn't give it. And some of the things that we discussed on the major principles, autonomy is respected in Jewish law. We respect the autonomy of others, we try to follow what he wants, but the limitations to autonomy are much higher than the limitations in secular ethics. So that sometimes patients will have to do things which will override their autonomy. I'll conclude with just a brief story that just recently happened at Shaare Tzedek. A diabetic patient who came with a gangrenous leg and said, I don't want you to amputate the leg. And he understood that it means that he's going to die. And if he will be amputated, he will live. He'll live with a prosthesis, he will live, maybe it depends if it's above knee, below knee, but he will live. The question is, what do you do? So in an autonomous world, like in the United States, your hands are tied. You can't force him to undergo an operation when he says, I don't want to do it. From a halachic point of view, he can't say, I don't want. He's obligated to get the treatment. And I'm obligated to save his life. So I have to force him to do what is in his benefit. By the way, from a beneficial point of view, if we go according to the four principles, obviously he needs the operation. That is in his benefit. But autonomy overrides. Halachically, autonomy doesn't override. And therefore, according to many poskim, he should be forced to do it. In the Israeli law, the law, you know, in Israel, they try to go according to the American standards with a leg of 10 years behind. So what was right 10 years ago in the United States becomes a law in Israel, where in the United States they already saw already the faults of it and they try to go back. So there was a law enacted, which is called the Patients' Rights Law, which is a very autonomous law, saying that you have to tell the patient everything and he has to make the decisions and you can't override his decisions. But we managed to include one clause which gives a medical ethics committee in a hospital the right to operate, to act against the autonomous wishes of the patient, provided three things are fulfilled. One is that the patient understood exactly what it means, this decision or that decision. Second, that the benefit from the intervention is much greater than not intervening. And thirdly, that the ethics committee has good reason to assume that if the patient will be forced to this procedure and it will be successful, he will retroactively agree. Which means that the ethics committee needs to be prophets. They need to prophesize that they will make a decision and at the end it will work out well. So we had this case and I consulted some of the poskim in Yerushalayim and they all felt that this patient has to have the operation. Now, everyone understands you can't go against the law. So here we have a leeway according to the law. So we needed to get some reasonable assumption that this particular patient might retroactively agree. And we worked hard on the family to understand his dynamics. I don't want to go into it. And we made a decision that we feel that there's a reasonable chance that he will thank us at the end. And we went ahead and we amputated his leg. Not me, I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, but whoever did it. And the patient woke up without part of his leg. He didn't scream, he didn't yell, he didn't say, what did you do? I told you not to do it. When a complication occurred, the physician asked him, you know, this complication might lead to the fact that we will need to reintubate you in order to bring you through the infections and all the complications. Do you agree to it? He said, of course. So to me, that is a sign that he really agreed. He wanted to stay alive. Why didn't he want it to begin with? We have a lot of theories. But the fact is that he wants to live. And I think the lesson to learn from it is that even if you go according to autonomy, not always can we rely on what the patient is saying as the first thing that he says. He may have said it. He may have said it because he was upset, or he didn't understand exactly what it means, or he was frightened, or whatever. But at the end of the day, if it is a beneficial act, sometimes the autonomy can be interpreted in a different way. It's not against autonomy, it's a different interpretation of autonomy. But be it as it may, these are some of the differences between secular and Jewish medical ethics, and obviously all that we will talk during the coming days will be some comparisons between a secular approach and a Jewish approach, and we'll probably see many more of those differences. And I thank you for your attention.
We'll just take a few questions now. If you could stand up and
Well, there wasn't a precedent yet, so I don't know. But, again, I'm saying that the law provided for it. I mean, the ethics committee can say, we assume, based on ABC, which we gathered, and they were real things, we didn't do it just as a trick, that this personality of this patient is such that he says something and then he agrees to other things as well. So the assumption was there. And even if it will turn out that we were mistaken, for mistakes, you are not punished.
You mentioned that in the Israeli rights law that you have included these three criteria that you allowed to underline. And one of them that was the patient could need to understand it. And I'm just wondering why they inserted that, because to me, that, you know, if the patient didn't understand it, that would be an easy way out. You could declare the patient incompetent.
Right. No. The idea is that we're talking about a competent patient. He's known to be a competent patient. Now, if he didn't understand and you enforced him to undergo a treatment, that would be a violation of your responsibility to make him understand it. Okay?
So you mentioned the public health policy questions about allocation of resources and so forth. But from the perspective of the individual physician treating patients, are we not, and I'm interested to hear your response to this, we're facing now a change in the ethic that is imposed on us. In other words, until now, it has been our job to do the best we can for each individual patient. Now we're going to be in a situation where that's not our job now. Our job is now to do the best for the society as a whole. And we as individual physicians now have to make triage decisions as if we are battlefield medics, not individual physicians taking care of individual patients. Is that correct?
Well, I think you are right that this is the trend, but I think the trend is wrong. What I think is right to do is to take into account triage situations, because that's a necessity. I mean, we can't give every patient everything. That's impossible. But who will be the advocate for the patient? And I think that the treating physician has to do and fight for his patient to the best of his ability. It is the society's obligation as well to stop certain things, so that this fight will balance between what is good for the individual and what is good for society. If the physician automatically goes to the side of society, then the patients will lose. Now, within physician's decision, you can include triage decisions. For instance, if you have two drugs and both are effective, but you know that one is cheaper, don't give him the most expensive one. It still is for the good of the patient, and you took into account the triage decisions. Therefore, in some medical schools, they teach medical students economy so that they'll understand the economical value of their decisions. But if it means not to treat the patient or not to provide him a certain type of treatment altogether for triage decisions, I think that the physician's obligation is to try to get it, and the society has to try not to get it, and they should balance the results. Yes. Bottom line, yes. But the way we get to this bottom line is a lot of steps, and it's not my task now to go and explain all of this. But there is a concept that's called Mishum Eiva. For hatred, if you will not treat well a non-Jew, then the non-Jew will not treat well a Jew. And then by you not treating well the non-Jew, you are causing a pikuach nefesh to a Jew. That is called Mishum Eiva. And currently all the poskim agree that you should treat equally the non-Jew as the Jew, including desecrate Shabbat for him and treat him the same way as you would have treated a Jew. That is the bottom line. The bottom line is equal. If you want to talk about equality, so it's equal. But the way we get to it is a little more complicated. Yes?
I'm just wondering if it's best to bring that to the conversation. What is the actual, the mechanism of getting the patient?
Well, he lost consciousness. No, he lost consciousness. He became septic, and he lost consciousness. Now, some say that once the patient lost consciousness, it's a new game. And now we can make decisions. We didn't go this easy way. We knew that a minute ago he said he doesn't want. So the fact that he lost consciousness is not enough to say, okay, so now we don't know what he wants anymore, and we'll do it for him. We know that he doesn't want. That's the last thing he said. And yet we thought that he should have it because from a Jewish point of view, we are obligated to save his life. And we assume, based on the construction of what we built of the dynamics of his personality, that it's reasonable that he will agree, which we happen to be right in this case.
So what if he didn't?
Now, if he doesn't lose consciousness, so you could tie him and inject him Valium and put him to sleep and do it. I don't think that it would be easy, and that wasn't the case. I don't know what we would have decided if he would be conscious and saying no, and how you can't get the police to the OR. So that might have been a problem, but this part of the problem was solved naturally. Yes. Right. So there are many issues that the law of the land is against halacha. Many issues in a dying patient, in abortion. There are a lot of issues where the law of the land requires to do certain things which halacha doesn't allow or requires to do it differently. I think that the right approach would be that the physician who feels that this is against his belief, against his religion, should stay away from the case, should transfer the case to somewhere else. He's not responsible for the whole world. He can't fight the whole world and do what he thinks is right, despite the fact that the whole world thinks differently. But the world cannot impose on him to do something which to him is wrong. By the way, in the Israeli law, there are such exemptions in the law, maybe in the United States as well. For instance, in the abortion law in Israel, where certain reasons for abortion are permissible by law but are not acceptable halachically, a physician who doesn't want to do the abortion because of the halachic implication is allowed by law to transfer the case to someone else. We did the same with the dying patient law. If a physician thinks that he should treat the patient and the patient doesn't want, then by law You don't need to treat him anymore. He can abstain from the case and transfer it to someone else. Yeah, but it's not your responsibility is not to save the whole world. You do the best that you can for your patient. If you have the power to do it, you are obligated to do it. If you don't have the power, you can't do it. So at least the power shouldn't impose on you to do something which you don't feel right.
Yeah. It sort of brings a bit of a contradiction because at the beginning you also said you have no right to refuse a patient, you have to treat a patient, you can't really choose, and yet in this case, keeping the patient is going to go against your principles or your halakha. When you transfer it, you're giving up.
No, so what I'm trying to distinguish is between the philosophical aspect and the real life aspect. I mean, you can't be responsible for the world. You can't change the whole world. You can do what is right. In an optimal way, you should treat the patient or you should not treat the patient. You should perform both or you shouldn't. But if the law of the land is such that you can't do it, so you can't do it. You can't change the world. But at least don't do something which you feel is wrong, and that the country has to give you the right to do it.
The last, very last question, Esther, you have the floor.
Okay. In an emergency where you can't have a very bad, ugly case of the
again, I'm saying there are limits to what we can do. I mean, if the situation is such that what you think is right to do is legally wrong to do, then you can't do it. How do you get out of it? The best way is to ask someone else to do it instead of you. And if this is impossible, you do the best you can within the limits of what the law allows you. I don't think there's a black and white answer to such issue where the law is against you. You're not required to go to jail for the principle that you have to treat a patient. If the law will put you to jail or will take away your license, so I think these are limitations that can't be overcome.